Good afternoon. My name is Ophelia Cepeda, and on behalf of the American Indian Studies Program, the Poetry Center, and the Southwest Center, and Women's Studies, I would like to welcome you all to this afternoon's program, a reading by Lucy Tapahanso. Another poet, Inscott Mamaday, often talks about the power of words. The power does not necessarily mean the power found in ceremonial oration or the power of words held in curing songs. It can mean ordinary power in ordinary words. It is something that is always there. Thus, each speaker must be prepared to take full responsibility of his or her utterances. In the Journal of Navajo Life, Lucy talks about a sense of herself. She focuses on her two linguistic worlds, the Navajo oral tradition and her second language, English. She writes, "Because I was born into and came out an oral culture, I learned early that the use of words involves responsibility and respect for oneself. A person is known primarily by his use of language and song. One's family and upbringing are reflected in the way he or she talks among others. So one does not act alone in the use of words or song. It always involves his parents, his family, and distant relatives." Lucy talks about this responsibility and the use of language by relaying an incident about a song. She talks about herself and her father as they are driving to a poetry reading. She writes, "As part of the song, there are a few notes that seem to dip and lower. Then the song repeated itself. I felt I had to get that tiny part accurate before it was sung in public. I asked my father if he remembered it, and he did. He was sitting in the back seat looking out at the mountains, then leaning forwards towards me to listen as I sang. He sang it over and over again. After a half hour or so, I finally learned it right, and we sang it all the way into Durango. Before the reading, I asked my father if he thought I should sing that particular song as it was attached to a poem. He said, 'If you know the song and like it when you sing, then sing it. It's your song. The English in the poem, though, is not yours. You are only borrowing that. Once you read it to others, it becomes theirs also. You are responsible for what that may create. You should be careful with that particular use of English.'" And now some facts about Lucy Tapahanso, our guest this afternoon. Beginning this year, Lucy started a tenure-track position at the University of New Mexico in English. And I seem to somehow identify with her position in that it says, in one piece it said that her position is at UNM is in English, Native American Studies, and Women's Studies. Her appointment is in creative writing within the English department with the focus in poetry, Native American, and Southwestern women's literature. Lucy is a native of Shiprock, New Mexico. And those of you familiar, of course, know that she is very well published. Her first book of poetry, One More Shiprock Night, was published in 1981. Her collection titled Seasonal Woman has been reprinted for the fourth time. Collection A Breeze Swept Through is due out this year if it hasn't come out already. Lucy's work also has appeared in anthologies, in particular Sinister Wisdom and in 20th Century American Indian Writers. Her latest project involves translating Tilly Olson's short story I Stand Here Ironing into Navajo. Lucy is here this weekend in part of as a participant of the conference up at the Westward Look called Open Spaces, City Spaces, and she's on the agenda tomorrow morning, I believe. So would you all please welcome Lucy Tapahanso.
Ophelia. Can you hear me? Okay. Yeah, I'm Lucy Tapahanso, and I, as Ophelia said, come from Shiprock. Dinenshlinigi, I want to begin this reading with the last poem in my book. It's called There Is Nothing Quite Like This, and it's a combination of poetry and song, which I began doing a few years ago, and I really like, I think that it's a natural combination. It works well for me. This is the poem that ends this book. It's called There Is Nothing Quite Like This. A cream-colored horse galloping in the sunrise, circling to the east four times in the pink morning sky. Look, the streaks of purple in gray clouds. The horse runs hard, raising dust. The dawn is still. We watch. There is nothing quite like this to see. Hey ne young, hey yo, hey ne young, hey yo, hey ne young, hey yo, hey hey young, hey yo, hey hey young, hey young, hey young, hey hey young, a young, away yo, hey ne young. The rider, straw hat and rawhide whip. He yells out on the west side of the Havan. He yells out four times on the west. Hey, 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 hey. Hey, ne young, hey, oh, yeah, hey, ne young, hey, oh, yeah, hey, ne young, hey, oh, yeah, hey, hey, young, hey, oh, yeah, hey, hey, young, a young, hey, hey, young. They have heard the spirits are coming. They are coming now. The western sky, a matrix of quick lightning streaks in dark, dark clouds. The Lugajigai Mountains are damp, dripping with rain. Even from here in the desert we know. We watch the cream-colored horse and the rider with the strong morning yell. Hey, ne young, hey, oh, yo, hey, ne young, hey, oh, yo, hey, ne young, hey, oh, yo, hey, hey, young, hey, oh, yo, hey, hey, young, a young, hey, hey, young, a young, hey, hey, young. Take heed, they circle four times around the Havan. They have come, the spirits singing and healing. We are better now for seeing this, a cream-colored horse galloping in circles, the pink sunrise and the warm desert morning. Already at 6 a.m. it's hot, and we return to the fires to cook and catch up on the latest stories around this area. Hey, ne young, hey, oh, yo, hey, ne young, hey, oh, yo, hey, ne young, hey, oh, yo, hey, hey, young, hey, oh, yo, hey, hey, young, a young, hey, hey, young, young, oh, yo, hey, ne young, hey, oh, yo, hey, hey, young, hey, oh, yo, hey, hey, young, hey, oh, hey, young, hey, oh, hey, oh, hey, hey, young, a young, hey, hey, young, a young, oh, hey, oh, hey, nay, young, hey, young. Next one I want to read is one that is based on a story that I heard. It actually is based on several stories that I heard, and then what I did was sort of make my own version of the story. Because I didn't want to be sued by the actual people in the story. It's called Last Year the Pinyons Were Plentiful. It took only a late night phone call, listening and laughing in the bedroom dark. Her husband was lying right there, but one-sided conversations never make sense. And it made no sense right from the beginning. The blue moonlight slid down the long center curve of his back as he got up to take a drink of water. After the phone call, she had snow-laced dreams where she was trying to catch the dark horse and the other was chuckling under his breath. She smelled chamisa when she woke and knew what had happened. Far away, the other was going to feed the horses beneath Tuahale Mountain. The air was heavy with rain scent, sage, and rabbit brush. But here, the morning light bolted into the room in streaks, where her nightgown was a rumpled heap under the bed, and she remembered only the phone call. And the time she followed him into the trading post, a skinny dog at her heels. He bought her a Coke, and they sat on the dusty steps outside, not even talking. The sun was hot and sticky, fine dirt settling on them. That was when he said, "It's better here in the spring. Maybe you'll come back then." As she drove off, she saw him in the rear view mirror, mounting the dark horse. That was how it was that day. Here she cleaned the house thoroughly, and at noon he called again, saying, "Come on out. The clouds are still real low in the mornings, but it warms up. We can ride over the mountain if you want." And she did. "I have no choice," she told herself, leaving her nightgown on the floor and her husband waiting at lunch. She took the next trailways to Gallup, a radio, and a can of coffee. People saw them at the trading post at Newcomb, reading the bulletin board. They left on a dark horse towards Two Gray Hills late in the afternoon and weren't seen again that spring. "It doesn't make sense," her husband said. She seemed happy, but happiness had nothing to do with it. And years from now, her grandchildren will understand, saying, "Back then, those things always happened." That was last year. The pinyons were large, and the winter so cold, so cold. Beneath Tuahale Mountain, the white desert, shining with snow. And the original story, not the original, because no one knows the original, but the story that I heard, they actually went to Disneyland. Excuse me a minute. And they said that some people from that area, the people that did this, were actually from Ninahansad, which is, I guess, east of Shiprock. They said they saw them at Disneyland, and they were share riding in a teacup. If you've been to Disneyland, you know that, you know, the rides are in teacups, and they're real pretty. You can sit in the cup and ride in it. That's what they were doing. This is called "I Am Singing Now." The moon is a white sliver balancing the last of its contents in the final curve of the month. My daughters sleep in the back of the pickup, breathing small clouds of white in the dark. They lie warm and soft under layers of clothes and blankets. How they dream, precious ones, of grandma and the scent of fire, the smell of mutton. They are already home. I watch the miles dissolve behind us in the hazy glow of taillights and the distinct shape of hills and mesas loom above, then recede slowly in the clear winter night. I sing to myself and think of my father teaching me, leaning towards me, listening as I learned. "Just like this," he would say, and he would sing those old songs into the fiber of my hair, into the pores of my skin, into the dreams of my children. And I am singing now for the night, the almost empty moon, and the land swimming beneath cold, bright stars. This is called Yes, It Was My Grandmother. Yes, it was my grandmother who trained wild horses for pleasure and pay. People knew of her saying, she knows how to handle them. Horses obey that woman. She worked skirts flying, hair tied securely in the wind and dust. She rode those animals hard, was thrown time and time again. She worked until they were meek and wanting to please. She came home at dusk, tired and dusty, smelling of sweat and horses. She couldn't cook, my father said, smiling. Your grandmother hated to cook. Oh, grandmother, who freed me from cooking. Grandmother, you must have made sure I met a man who would not share the kitchen. I am small like you and do not protect my careless hair from wind or rain. It tangles often, Grandma, and it is wild and untrained. This is called Just Because of Those Boots. This week is the rodeo finals in Albuquerque. And when we left, there was a lot of people coming into town. Just because I put on my deep turquoise blouse and new dark jeans, he asked, are you going to Indian Day at the fair? I don't know, I said, putting on silver earrings and strands of coral and turquoise beads. It depends on the girls, I said. He was waiting to see if I was going to put on my boots. That's a sure sign, so I didn't put them on. Old Indian trick, I thought, slipping on flat brown shoes. Sometimes no one can be certain. This is called Hills Brothers Coffee. My uncle is a small man in Navajo. We call him Little Father, my mother's brother, Da'iyaj. He doesn't know English, but his name in the white way is Tom Jim. He lives about a mile or so down the road from our house. One morning he sat in the kitchen drinking coffee. I just came over, he said. The store is where I'm going. He tells me about how my mother seems to be gone every time he comes over. Maybe she sees me coming, then runs and jumps in her car and speeds away, he says, smiling. We both laugh just to think of my mother jumping in her car and speeding. I pour him more coffee and he spoons sugar and cream until it looks almost like a chocolate shake. Then he sees the coffee can. Ah, that's the coffee with the man in a dress, like a church man. Ah, that's the one that does it for me. Very good coffee. I sit down again and he tells me, some coffee has no kick, but this one is the one. It does it good for me. I pour us both a cup. And while we wait for my mother, his eyes crinkle with a smile, and he says, yes, yes, this is the very one, putting in more cream and sugar. So I usually buy Hills Brothers Coffee once or sometimes twice a day. I drink a hot coffee, and it does it for me. This is a fairly new piece of work, it covers a few generations. The one that I read for you, that I said was for my grandmother, is my Shanalit and my father's mother. This one is based on my mother's mother, the Shamasane. It begins in 1935. Kintlecheepitsit waited, looking east on the snow-covered plain stretching out before her. Snow was falling lightly and the desert was flat and white. From where she stood at the foothills of the Carrizo Mountains, she could see for miles. This first section that I'm reading you begins in 1935. She would see him as he approached, a small dark speck on the vast whiteness, moving slowly but closer. Her son, pretty boy, tall and lanky with the sure-footed horse. She would see him. All evening she kept watch, stepping out every once in a while. He left to go to some relatives at Little Shiprock and would have returned by now. But it had begun snowing early and continued into the evening. She knew Pretty Boy had started home before the storm and was coming home now. She kept watch, looking out on the horizon. In those days, hogans had no windows, so she stood outside in front of the door, a shawl around her shoulders. Only her eyes were uncovered as she squinted, looking out into the desert night. Nihumadesk, as her children called her back in. Our mother, it's cold. She would come in for a while and then went back out to watch for him again. All evening they waited, and her children urged her not to worry. He would be home soon. She wasn't cold, she said, and she would wait for him outside again. Finally, she saw him, a dark speck on the horizon, and she rushed in. She stirred up the fire, heated up stew, and put on a fresh pot of coffee. She heated the grease for fry bread. He came in damp and cold with snow. They laughed because his eyebrows were frozen white. Tell us about your trip, they said to him. Tell us everything about your trip. While he ate, he told about their relatives and the news that he had heard from the area. He said the horse seemed to know the way by itself coming back through the snow and cold. He kept his head down most of the way, he said. It was blowing snow. The family finally went to bed happy and relieved that Pretty Boy was home safe. Outside, the wind blew and snow formed drifts around the hogan. In the morning, Kintlecheepitsit was sick, feverish and dizzy. She didn't get up and they gave her blue corn mush and wheat tea to drink. She slept most of the day and felt warm. Her family began to worry. The nearest medical doctor was in Shiprock, 40 miles to the east, and on horseback it was a full day's journey. Even then, the doctor was at the agency only 2 days a week, and they couldn't remember which days he was there. The medicine man lived higher up on the mountainside, and they decided until morning to go over there and tell him if they must. She would get better, they said, and they prayed and sang songs for those who have chills and the winter within them. That night, very late, she became ill and talked incessantly about her children and her grandchildren. She died before morning, and Pretty Boy went out in the snow and blowing wind to tell other relatives who lived at scattered distances from Kintlecheepitsit's hogan. People gathered quickly, and despite the snow, they came from all around to help out with the next 4 days. This next section is 1968. The granddaughter of Kintlecheepitsit said, my uncle Pretty Boy died today, and we went over to his house. His aunt, my grandma, was sweeping out her hogan and scolding the young people around for not helping out. They were listening to the radios and their pickups and holding hands. You know, they were just teenagers. My grandma is 104 years old, and my real grandma, Kentla Chibitsa, would have been 106 if she didn't die before I was born. I know about her and I love her, the story I know and the way she was. I think I'm like her in many ways. At Pretty Boy's house, his wife and children were sitting in the front room and everyone came in and spoke to them quietly. They were crying and crying, sometimes loudly, sometimes sobbing. Pretty Boy was a tall man and he died of cancer. It was awful because he didn't even smoke. He worked in the mines near Red Rock. Last week when we were hoeing in the field, my mother said, "Having a mother is everything. I never knew that until my mother died." Your mother is your home, she said. When children come home, your mother is always ready with food, stories, and songs. She's always happy and glad to see her children and grandchildren. My mother always told me this as I was growing up. That day when we were hoeing corn, I said, "Tell me that story again about my grandmother and how you knew that time that something was wrong. Tell me the story, Shema." She said, "That night Pretty Boy was coming home, I knew something was wrong. The wind blew hard and it whistled through the tall pine trees. We lived then in the mountains at Nista, about 10 miles above where my mother lived. We were just married then. Our first baby, your oldest sister, was a month old. That night the dogs barked wildly and loudly. They were afraid of something. Then they stopped suddenly. Your father and I looked at each other across the room. Then we heard the coyotes barking and yelping outside. He opened the door and they were circling the hogan, running around and around, yelping and howling at the same time. Your father grabbed his rifle. I was crying inside. I knew something was going to happen. He had his rifle and he shot at them, the two coyotes, but he missed each time. He missed. He had been a sharpshooter or a marksman or something like that in the army, and he couldn't shoot them. He had even gotten awards for that. He couldn't shoot them. Finally, they ran off and we were afraid that night. We prayed and talked about what had happened. We couldn't go anywhere. The snow was deep and even the horses would have a hard time. In the morning, I went out to pray and I saw him. My brother, Pretty Boy, was riding up to our hogan. He was still far off and only a little dot on the desert, but even then I knew something had happened. I tried not to cry, and even then I knew in my bones something within me, something had happened. My brother would not ride out to visit us in that weather. Even though the sun was out, the snow was frozen cold, and the wind blew steadily. I held the baby and prayed, crying. I hoped I was wrong. Finally, he came up the hill to our hogan, and I went out and I saw by the way he rode that horse, he was crying. He wouldn't look to see where he was going. The horse led my brother, who was crying. I watched him, and then he saw me. "Shinai," I yelled, "Shinai, Shinai." He got off the horse and ran to me, crying, "Shideja, Nihimaadin, my baby sister, our mother's gone, our mother's gone." My heart fell, and we cried and cried. The wind stopped blowing, and we went inside. I held my baby girl and told her that she would not see her grandmother. None of our other children would either. We packed up our things and began down the mountain for the 4 days. My mother died and I realized that she was my home. She would always welcome me. And since I was the youngest, she called me her baby. "Even if you are a grandmother," she said, "you will always be my baby." My mother tells me the story and she cries and I cry. Even if I knew Kinsler Chibitza all my life, I wouldn't love her more than I do now, knowing her only through stories of my mother's memory. She had talked to my father a week before she died and said, "Take care of her. Aisha, where's my baby? She's my youngest. I trust you and have faith that you will care for her like I have all these years. She's my baby. She knows what to do. Listen to her. Remember, a woman's wisdom is not foolish. She knows a lot because I have raised her to be a good and kind person." My father did. He treated my mother well, and he listened to her and always abided by her wishes. This last section is 1985. The great-granddaughter of Kinsler Chibitza said, "Early this morning we went out to pray. The corn pollen drifted into the swimming pool. It became little specks of white on the blue pool cover. The water lapped quietly against the edges. We prayed, and I asked my ancestors, my grandparents, and uncles who died before to over me. I am going so far away. Europe, what a trip this will be. My mother cried when I left, and my grandma called me last night. I was nervous and I couldn't sleep. I felt like canceling my plans, but my mother had spent all that money. Remember who you are, she said. You're from Oak Springs. Remember, all your relatives are thinking about you and praying for you to come back safely and do well on your trip. I stuffed the pollen in my purse. At the airport at LaGuardia, I ran to the bathroom and tasted some. My mother, I thought, my grandmother helped me. It was confusing and so loud. Everyone smokes and talks loudly. I wanted my mother's slow, soft voice then more than anything. I was the only Indian in the group, so no one knew how I felt. They were looking at boys and laughing and talking loudly. I had the pollen, though. I was afraid they would arrest me at customs for an unknown substance. But they didn't. I was meant to go to Paris. I prayed on top of the Eiffel Tower, and pollen floated down to the brick plaza below. I was so far from home, so high above everything. The tower swayed a little and the wind blew. I never missed Indians until I went abroad. I was lonely to see an Indian the whole time. People thought I was neat being a real Indian. They wanted to learn Navajo, and they asked me all kinds of questions. It was weird to be a real Indian. All along, I was just a regular one of the laughing at home with my relatives and friends, mixing Navajo and English, telling jokes about cowboys and computer warriors. I learned that what I am is my mother, her mother, and my grandmother, Kinsler Chibitza, who I never met but always knew. It was her that made sure I got through customs and wasn't mugged in Paris. And it was her I came back to. My grandmother was at the airport crying and hugging me. My mother stood back, then came forward and cried softly. I was home. This is, people always get names by things that they do, and this one is a poem about that. One cold winter afternoon, the baby ran outside when no one was looking. She ran, laughing and waving her arms around. "The baby," someone yelled, and we ran out after her. She heard us and ran even faster down the sloping roads, hills to the orchard. We could hear her laughing and squealing. The dogs were bounding alongside her in the snow. Finally, she was caught and they brought her back in. She was still laughing, her cheeks and arms were red, and she was just happy, breathing hard, and her eyes were sparkling. She hadn't been outside all winter. She escaped, my brother said. After that, she always liked to run outside every chance she got and run down to the road. So her name became Beep Beep, because she liked to be a runner and liked to have people try to catch her. I'm going to end with this. This is a poem that is called Raisin Eyes. I saw my friend Ella with a tall cowboy at the store the other day in Shiprock. Later, I asked her, "Who's that guy anyway?" "Oh, Lucy," she said. I knew what was coming. "It's terrible. He lives with me and my money and my car. But just for a while, he's an AIRCA and rodeos a lot, and I still work. This rodeo business is getting to me, you know. I'm going to leave him because I think all this I'm doing now will pay off better somewhere else. But I just stay with him and it's hard because he just smiles that way, you know. And then I end up paying entry fees and putting shiny Tony Llamas on layaway again. It's not hard. But he doesn't know when I'll leave him and I'll drive across the flat desert from Red Rock in blue morning light straight to Shiprock so easily. And anyway, my car is already used to humming a morning song with Gary Stewart, complaining again of aching and breaking down and out love affairs. Damn, these Navajo cowboys with raisin eyes and pointed boots are just bad news. But it's so hard to remember that all the time, she said with a little laugh. I think that this is my first book, which is out of print, and in a way, I feel like saying thank heavens, because it was work that was, it was my first book, and the work in it was like over 10 years, and hopefully work improves as one works more, you know, it improves and refines itself. But I thought that since a lot of this work is based in Phoenix, when I lived there, that I thought that I would read a few of these. I haven't read from this book in a long time. This is called Conversation. We stopped wondering why things happen like they do. Saturday at a party, I saw you passed out on top of a red car. When we were at Esquire drinking and laughing, I saw that lady. I babysat her kids once. They cried all night for her. I wonder if my baby cries. Maybe she's used to it by now. Towards evening, I get restless being alone, to have a man appreciate a good meal, to sleep beside a warm, strong body, to whisper and laugh over a 2 o'clock snack. After everything, I could easily welcome him back. Sometimes in the quiet darkness of night, when I worry of rent, groceries, and diapers, I even curse him and hope his eyes are dead and look at nothing. Pretty strong. This is called Running Horses. When she was a child, it was a nightmare and sound like horses. Horses running in the night, thundering hooves somewhere close, but it was always so dark she couldn't see where they were, and she was afraid and excited. That night at the bar, when he came up behind her, it was that same feeling. He held her by the waist and moved her firmly onto the dance floor. He wore a black hat and a silver buckle, and they danced jukebox music, barroom smoke, people laughing, moving, blurred, swirling, swirling. She was sweating and trying to focus her eyes. It was so fast. He turned her around and round so smoothly, her arms twisting easily above her head, and she heard her hair slapping against his waist as they turned, dancing, and the music stopped. They stood side by side. "Let's just go," he said. She turned, trying to see his eyes. He held her hand and led her, almost pulling her out of the bar. Outside, the air was cooled, and they walked fast, almost running to a dark pickup. "Wait," he said, "wait right here." He went into the alley darkness, gravel grinding under his boots, and she waited, breathing loud, shivering through sweat, waiting. It was that same feeling. She remembered it now. He didn't come back, and she waited for the echo of his heavy boots from the alley. And she hugged herself, shivering. Suddenly, the muffled barroom noises seemed safer, safer than this, and she ran to the wooden bar door, about to scream. Inside, she rushed to her friends. "He left," she said, shaking. "He just left. That guy I danced with just left." "You went out alone," they said. "You didn't dance with anyone." She sat down, trying to think. "He was here. We danced," she said out loud. "We danced." "Oh, he was at the door, shiny black coat and a silver bridle, and he was a thundering horse, breathing, snorting in darkness. His eyes glistened as he moved to her. She couldn't see, and she swirled, twisting her neck, trying to see running horses in the dark." This particular poem was the focus of a painting that Emmy Whitehorse did. It's a real nice painting, and the poem, we printed it along with the painting, and it turned out really nice. She paints horses really well. This is based on a Navajo called A Discreet Conversation. I'll translate it into Navajo after I've done the poem. "He was drunk and rolled his car twice, but didn't get hurt. Somehow he drove his car off the road and wrecked it," his sister said. General murmurs of sympathy. "No one knows how it happened," his mother added. Silence. Then the old grandpa said in a loud voice, "You better go with him next time he gets paid," they said to his wife. What the grandfather says is, let me see the translation here. "He was drinking too much, of course, but that doesn't happen to one who has eaten too much." But it is a very translation, because what he's really saying, if I could say it better in English, is he was drinking, of course, really means like eating, like really, you know, pigging it. Yeah? Except that it refers to, I think it, really refers more to meat or to mutton than it would to like French fries or something else like that. I read this at Shiprock, and people were just laughing, and it seems funny to read it. So audience makes a difference sometimes. I can hardly read it sometimes without laughing myself. In any case, thank you for having me. I love the weather down here. We came down all dressed for winter in our sweaters and turtlenecks and everything. And so, but it's really nice here, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you.